Chapter 6 Five Element Symbolism and the Stupa. In every part of the world, the landscape has its own distinctive appearance, shaped by the forces of nature and the design of mankind. To the natural scene, mountains, hills or plains, barren desert or lush forest, human beings contribute architectural features of many kinds, mud huts or thatched cottages, magnificent pyramids, soaring church spires, or clusters of skyscrapers, even enormous slag heaps and smoking factory chimneys. Since its beginnings in India, Buddhism has spread over an area extending from the deserts of Central Asia in the west as far as the islands of Japan in the east, from the icy wind-swept tablelands of Tibet in the north, right down to the sun-drenched tropical island of Sri Lanka in the south. The natural features of all these areas are very different, and so are their architectural features. But wherever you travel throughout this vast area, there's one type of architectural monument which is found everywhere, on bleak mountain tops, in pleasant wooded valleys, in the midst of vast plains and by the seashore. This ubiquitous Buddhist monument is the stupa. Over the years, the stupa has assumed a number of different forms, sometimes so different that it is almost impossible to tell that they spring from the same origins. There are stupas made of brick and stupas made of stone. Some are even made of precious metals, gold and silver, and studded with precious gems. Some stupas are so large that it would take you 10 minutes to walk all the way around them, while others are so small that you can hold them in the palm of your hand. Interesting as the history of the stupa is, however, it is not its place in the history of Buddhist art that concerns us here, but its profound symbolic significance. The stupa is one of the richest and most complex symbols in the whole field of Buddhism, especially of Mahayana Buddhism, and it also happens to be a symbol which occurs, very dramatically, in the White Lotus Sutra. The stupa makes its appearance in the 11th chapter of the sutra, roughly halfway through, not reckoning the chapters that seem to be later additions, so that it divides the whole sutra into two great halves. The first half is dominated by the parables, the burning house, the return journey, the rain cloud. But although the second half, including the appearance of the stupa, does include the occasional parable, it is almost completely taken over by myth and symbol, and by what we might call cosmic phantasmagoria. To generalize further, the first half is concerned with the way to enlightenment, especially the Mahayana, the great way, and with the progress of the Bodhisattva along that way. The second half, by contrast, is concerned with enlightenment, the goal. It is dedicated to the Buddha and the concept of the Buddha field, the spiritual world in which the Buddha reigns. Becoming more abstract still, we can say that in the first half of the sutra we see the whole of existence sub specie temporis, under the form of time, whereas in the second half we see existence sub specie eternitatis, as it always was, is, and will be above and beyond time, in the dimension of eternity. The first half of the sutra therefore depicts spiritual perfection everlastingly in the process of attainment, whereas the second half depicts perfection eternally attained. And the stupa stands in between the two, not to separate them, but to unite them, for the symbol of the stupa contains both time and eternity. But before we can go any further, we need to ask a basic question. What is a stupa? The word stupa is Sanskrit and literally means the top. Thus it comes to refer both to the crown of the head and to the gable, the top of a house. Oddly enough, although the Indian word is rich in symbolic associations, it is etymologically connected with our much more ordinary English word, stump. But the etymological definition barely gives us a clue as to what the Buddhist symbol of the stupa might represent. A more useful starting point is the stupa's historical development. If we probe right back to the origins of the stupa, we find that it is as old as Buddhism itself, indeed far older. Its origins go directly back to the ancient Indian burial mound, to the pre-Buddhistic practice of heaping earth over the ashes of the heroic dead. The Mahaparinibbana Sutta tells us that in accordance with this ancient practice, the Buddha himself directed shortly before his death that a stupa should be erected over his remains. The sutta, the discourse from the Pali Canon which describes the Buddha's last days and death, goes on to give an account of how the Buddha's instructions were carried out. His body was placed on hundreds of logs which had been drenched in oil and clarified butter, and the pyre was set ablaze. It burned for a very long time, but when at last the flames had died down, the Buddha's lay disciples made a reverent search through the ashes, the cooling ashes, to find any small fragments of bone still remaining. The monks may have had sufficient equanimity to do without a physical memento of their great teacher, but the lay disciples had the very human desire, if it is a failing, it is a forgivable one, to preserve whatever relics they could. Unfortunately, no sooner had the relics been gathered together in a stone jar than a great quarrel arose among the disciples. If we take the representations of the scene in early Buddhist art literally, it would seem that the Buddha's ashes were barely cold when the different parties to the dispute were already almost ready to go to war with one another to decide who would take possession of them. Surprising as such a reaction to the death of a great teacher may seem, there is clearly something highly symbolic about it, for this is not the only incident of this kind in Buddhist tradition. After the death of the great yogi Milarepa, after his withdrawal from the mundane plane, his disciples were apparently just as greedy for relics as the Buddhas were. With characteristically apocalyptic and magnificent symbolism, the Tibetan legend describes how Milarepa's relics condensed into a brilliant globe of light which hovered above the heads of the disciples. When they tried to catch hold of it, it rose up into the air out of their reach. As soon as they lowered their grasping hands, it came a fraction lower, tantalizingly close, but always evading their grasp. Whether or not this literally happened, the symbolism is obviously of great significance. In the Buddha's case, many tribes and cities, and even kings and chiefs, laid claim to his relics. For instance, the Shakyas, the Buddha's own tribe, said, "The Buddha was born amongst us. If anyone has a right to the relics, surely we have." But the Mallas said, "He may have been born in Shakya territory, but it was our people he lived among and taught for so long. We certainly have a right to the relics." And so it went on, tribe after tribe, putting forward their respective claims. It took the intervention of a learned Brahmin to remind the disciples that it was unseemly, to say the least, for them to quarrel over the Buddha's relics as soon as he was dead. Brought to their senses in this way, the disciples at last settled the quarrel by dividing the relics into 8 equal portions, one for each tribe that had put in a claim. Each of these communities built over their share of the relics a stupa, and a stupa was also built over the jar in which the relics had been contained. The fact that this quarrel took place among the lay followers of the Buddha, the monks apparently having nothing to do with it, suggests that the practice of the worship of the relics of great men was not so much a part of the Buddha's own teaching as an ethnic practice which was still popular among his lay followers. Be that as it may, it is certainly the case that after the death of the Buddha, the veneration and decoration of stupas rapidly became, and remained, a highly popular religious practice, to the extent that for hundreds of years after the Buddha's death, the building, worship, and decoration of stupas was the principal religious practice for the laity. There were no temples in those days, and no images. The laity did not meditate or go to live in the jungle like the monks. So what religious practice could they do? They could make offerings to the stupas and venerate the relics therein, and in this way keep alive the memory of the Buddha and the great example he had shown. Although the Mahaparinibbana Sutta tells us that the Buddha directed his followers to build a stupa for his relics, it says nothing about how the Buddha wanted this to be done. It is a tradition coming down from Tibetan sources which gives us a few details. The story goes that when the Buddha told them to build a stupa, the disciples naturally asked in what form it should be made. In reply, the Buddha did not say anything but gave a practical demonstration. He took his outer yellow robe and folded it in two and two again, until the cloth formed a rough cube. Then he took his begging bowl, which of course was round, turned it upside down, and put it on top of the robes. "Make my stupa like this," he said. And the evidence of the archaeological remains of Buddhist sites in India suggests that this shape, a square base topped by a hemisphere, was indeed the oldest form of the stupa. At first, the monks, the full-time followers of the Buddha, were not too happy about relic and stupa worship, but it became so widespread and popular among the laity that eventually they had to accept the practice as orthodox. Indeed, according to records like the Katavatu, some of the monks explicitly ascribed great devotional and spiritual value to the practice of worshipping relics and stupas. By the time of the great king Ashoka, the 3rd century BCE ruler of the Magadha kingdom, who spread his rule all over India and founded the Maurya Empire, the practice was very firmly established. Ashoka himself, according to the accounts we have heard of him, was a great builder of stupas. The legends say that he built 84,000 stupas in a single day. Rather a tough job, even for Ashoka. We are told that to make this possible, Ashoka's spiritual preceptor stretched out his hand into the sky and held back the sun until the great work was finished, a variant of the Old Testament Joshua legend. From the time of Ashoka, stupas became ever larger and more elaborate, and they were the objects of more and more fervent devotion. Archaeologists have discovered stupas which at first were comparatively small, maybe only 15 or 20 feet across, then enlarged again and again by the simple expedient of putting another layer onto the basic structure of the cube and hemisphere. Not only did the stupas become bigger, some of them migrated overseas. Buddhists in Sri Lanka, in Burma, and in Central Asia started building their own stupas, some of them bigger and better even than the Indian ones. Only the great stupa at Borobudur is bigger than those built in Sri Lanka during the 1st century of the Christian era, the period when the White Lotus Sutra was written down. Here is Kern's version, not perhaps as poetic as could be wished, of the passage which describes the sudden appearance of the stupa in the middle of the sutra. "Then there arose a stupa, consisting of seven precious substances, from the place of the earth opposite the Lord, the assembly being in the middle, a stupa 500 yojanas in height and proportionate in circumference. After its rising, the stupa, a meteoric phenomenon, stood in the sky sparkling, beautiful, nicely decorated with 5,000 successive terraces of flowers, adorned with many thousands of arches, embellished by thousands of banners and triumphal streamers, hung with thousands of jewel garlands, and with hour plates and bells, and emitting the scent of xanthochimus and sandal, which scent filled this whole world. Its rows of umbrellas rose so far on high as to touch the abodes of the four guardians of the horizon and the gods. It consisted of seven precious substances, viz. Gold, silver, lapis lazuli, musaragalva, emerald, red coral, and Karketana stone. This stupa of precious substances once formed, the gods of paradise strewed and covered it with mandarava and great mandara flowers. And from that stupa of precious substances, there issued this voice. Excellent, excellent, Lord Shakyamuni, thou hast well expounded this Dharma Pariyaya of the lotus of the true law. So it is, Lord, so it is, Sugata. So this is the stupa which appears in the sutra, no doubt an idealized version of the sort of monument which could be seen all over India at the time the sutra was written down. But although we have placed the stupa in its historical context, this does not completely answer the question of what a stupa is. We still need to ask ourselves what it represents, what it symbolizes. And the answer to this question is bound up with the symbolism of the five elements. The five elements are the traditional ones: earth, water, fire, air, and ether or space. However, we must take these terms not literally, but symbolically. When we take the five elements symbolically, what do we have in mind? What did the builders of the stupas have in mind? The answer, in a word, is energy. Earth, in this sense, is not the dark, moist substance you scoop up from the ground. As a symbol, earth represents energy in a state of contraction and cohesion. The earth element is the principle of solidity, that which makes everything stick together, a bit like the law of gravity. So earth represents energy locked up, blocked, even frozen, petrified, crystallized. In the same way, water, as a symbolic element, is not the stuff you drink. It is energy in a state of oscillation or undulation, not completely blocked, but at the same time not truly free. It just goes backwards and forwards, between two points. This is the energy represented by the element water. Then, what does fire represent? Fire, of course, always rises upwards. When you kindle a fire, it never burns downwards, at least not of its own accord, but always goes straight up. So fire symbolizes energy moving upwards, ascending, sublimating, if you like. Fourthly, air symbolizes energy which is not just expanding and ascending, but also descending and spreading out on both sides. In other words, air is energy in a state of expansion, diffusing itself in all directions of space from one central point. The symbolism of the element, which for lack of an apt English word we have to translate as ether or space, is much more difficult to explain. In Sanskrit it is akasha, a word which is derived from a root meaning to shine, and which is sometimes applied to the sky. But in its real meaning, akasha represents the primordial energy of which the other four, earth, water, fire, air, are grosser manifestations. They are like waves of different shapes, forms, and configurations, while the ether, the space, the akasha, the brightness, the shining, is like the sea itself. In some contexts, just a hint at the true nature of akasha, it stands halfway between what we call matter and what we call spirit or consciousness. So the five elements symbolize different states of physical energy. We can see and experience them in the external world. Everything is composed of these qualities of solidity, fluidity, temperature, air, and space. And we experience them in ourselves, in the human body. Earth, we could say, is the quality of solidity and resistance of bone and muscle. Water is the fluid quantity of blood and lymph. Fire is the heat, the temperature of the body. Air is the intake of oxygen and the exhalation of carbon dioxide. And all of these are contained in the space which the body occupies. Of course, we have mental, psychical energies as well as physical energies, and these mental energies are also represented by the five elements. Looked at in terms of psychical energy, earth represents a state of psychological energy blockage, emotional blockage. When you are emotionally blocked, how do you feel? You feel contracted, constricted, shut up in yourself, all stiff and rigid and lifeless, like a mental corpse. This is the earth state. It is like that of a man so tightly bound that he is unable to stir hand or foot. He may just about be able to wiggle his little toe or blink his eyes, but that's all. Water represents a state of extremely limited mobility, like that of ice which has just started to thaw. In this state, your energy feels just slightly free. Blockages have been removed, at least to the extent that you can move a little from side to side. This state is like that of someone whose limbs are free, but who is imprisoned in a tiny cell only big enough for them to be able to pace backwards and forwards. Your energy is only partially liberated, so that you can just go backwards and forwards, or round and round in a narrow, closed circle. This is the state in which most people live. Fire represents a state of liberation of energy in an upward direction. Here, energy is being sublimated, and in this state you feel inspired, as though you are being lifted up, or exalted, as though you are walking on air. The fire state is like that of someone whose cell encloses them on all sides, but has no roof. It is open to the sky, open to the stars, and the captive is perfectly free to move in that direction. All they have to do is rise up into the air. And air is energy in the process of becoming completely liberated. All hindrances and psychological blockages are removed. You feel that you are expanding in all directions, transcending your narrow, limited individuality or selfhood. This state is like that of someone whose prison walls have suddenly fallen down, so that they are absolutely free to go in any direction they like. In fact, the metaphor begins to break down here because, as an individual, the ex-prisoner can only go in one direction at a time, but in the state symbolized by the element air, you can expand yourself simultaneously to all the quarters of space, which means transcending your own individuality. And how does Akasha, ether or space, fit into the picture? What can it possibly represent? To put it in a very general way, we can say that Akasha is the higher dimension within which all these movements take place. The non-movement of Earth, the undulating, oscillatory movement of water, the ascending movement of fire, the expanding movement of air, all these take place within Akasha, a dimension which is higher still, and which contains and includes them all. Taking this symbolism still further, we can say that the five elements also symbolize five different kinds of people. Earth symbolizes the psychologically and emotionally crippled person. Water symbolizes the so-called normal person, a person who has a certain amount of free energy but functions within narrow limits in a repetitive, reactive manner. Fire symbolizes the artist, the poet, the musician, the free thinker, and the meditator, because they are rising up, sublimating, ascending. Air symbolizes the mystic, who is engaged all the time essentially in transcending the self. And space symbolizes the fully illumined sage, who has accomplished that process of self-transcending. In other words, the Buddha. According to tradition, each of the five elements is associated with a color. Earth is associated with yellow, water with white, fire with bright flaming red, air with a beautiful pale green, and space with blue, or sometimes a golden flame color. And the elements are also associated with certain geometrical forms: earth with the cube, water with the sphere, fire with the cone or pyramid, air with a bowl shape or saucer shape, like the dome of the sky turned upside down, and space with a flaming jewel-like shape. There are many other sets of correlations. For instance, according to some traditional systems of yoga, the five elements are correlated with the five psychic centers within the human body. Earth is correlated with the lowest psychic centre, the one between the anus and the genitals. Water with the centre at the solar plexus. Fire with the heart centre. Air with the throat centre. And space with the centre at the top of the head. There is also a correlation of the five elements with the five Buddhas. But although the symbolism of the elements is such a fascinating subject in itself, it is time we applied it to our original question, what is a stupa? The five elements, as represented by different geometrical forms and by different colours, can be combined to give earth a yellow cube, water a white sphere, fire a red cone or pyramid, air a green bowl or saucer, and space a flame-coloured jewel-like shape. Some translators call it an accumulated sphere, but it actually looks more like a jewel. These coloured forms, arranged one on top of the other in an order of increasing subtlety and release of energy, give the basic structure of the stupa. The stupa symbolises, therefore, the progressive liberation of energy, the process of growth and development, the higher evolution. It thus embodies, in architectural terms, the entire meaning of Buddhism in general, and the White Lotus Sutra in particular. Small wonder that the stupa is so widespread, and so much an object of fervent devotion. In the course of centuries, the basic structure of the stupa has undergone many adaptations, some with a definite spiritual basis, others merely architectural or cultural. One of these changes in particular relates to a specific aspect of the symbolism of the elements, their correlation with the psychic centres of the human body. Imagine in front of you a human being seated cross-legged as though in meditation, and a stupa which is at the same height as the seated person. If you identify the positions of the psychic centres up the person's median nerve and look across to the stupa, you will find that the centres correspond with the successive geometrical forms. Now imagine that another cube, smaller than the cube at the base of the stupa, is placed between the sphere and the cone. If the whole six-shaped structure thus created is hollow, so that the cross-legged human being can sit inside it, his or her eyes will be on a level with that second smaller cube, so that if the cube happens to be transparent, the eyes will be visible through it. Now this may remind you of something. If you have ever been to Nepal, or if you have seen photographs of the stupas there, you will surely be reminded of the typical Nepalese stupa. On these stupas, on each side of the harmika, as the second higher cube is called, a pair of eyes is painted. When you see these stupas rising above the landscape in the distance, with these eyes on the sides, they produce a very strange effect indeed, especially because the stupas are so enormous that they completely dominate the landscape. The eyes look down at you with a slightly disapproving frown, which seems not to be imaginary. The presence of these pairs of eyes serves to remind us that the stupa is correlated with the human body itself, that the elements of the stupa correspond to the psychic centres, and that both represent an upward, progressive movement, a movement of spiritual evolution. But why should that second cube have been put there at all? Indeed, why should the cone, the saucer, and the jewel have been added to the two original simple elements, the cube and the sphere? And why is the conical part of the Nepalese stupa divided into sections which make it look as if it consists of a number of rings of gradually diminishing diameter? We can answer all these questions in terms of yin-yang symbolism. The terms yin and yang are not Indian but Chinese, and they represent a polarity of universal validity and importance. They also happen to be quite well known in the West, and I am making use of them for this reason. In considering the parables of the rain cloud and the sun, we saw that the yin principle is associated with the earth, with water, with the depths. whereas the yang principle is associated with the sky, with fire, with the heights. Yin is the negative, passive principle, the feminine principle, to use that term in a very specific way. Yang is the active, masculine principle, the positive principle. Yin is symbolized by the moon. Yang is symbolized by the sun. Yin is emotion, the unconscious. Yang is reason, the conscious mind. Yin is life. Yang is light. Yin, if you like, is the lower evolution. Yang is the higher evolution. In the course of the evolution of the individual, yin and yang must be harmonized, synthesized. The plant, as we have seen, is the joint product of soil and rain on the one hand, and of space and sunlight on the other. In much the same way, the growing individual is nourished by both yin and yang forces. Now, how does this tie up with the stupa? The pre-Buddhistic burial mound consisted simply of a great heap of earth, a tumulus, a barrow, a place where the remains of heroes, kings and sages were enshrined, and which was the focus for the rites of the cult of the dead. This heap of earth came naturally to be associated with the earth, and therefore with the womb of Mother Nature, and the maternal in general. In its original form, then, the stupa was a symbol of the yin principle. The earliest Buddhist stupas, made up of the cube and the sphere or hemisphere, still had this association with yin, for both the cube and the sphere are yin symbols, or lunar symbols. So where did the smaller cube come from? And what is the origin of the triple umbrella by which in many stupas the cube is surmounted? These two symbols come from an ancient Indian pre-Buddhistic cult parallel to the cult of the dead, the cult of the sun. Of the many solar symbols in ancient India, two are of particular importance, the sacred fire and the sacred tree. The sacred fire burned on the hearth of every orthodox follower of the Vedas, and it also burned in the middle of the village, on a cubiform brick altar in a small shrine, an idealized hut. This hut often stood at the foot of the sacred tree of the village, a peepal or a banyan tree, for the tree was also a solar symbol. So the Harmika, the second cube of the stupa, symbolizes the original fire altar, and the umbrella by which it is surmounted is a stylized version of the sacred tree. So we can see how the stupa gradually developed. Two solar symbols, the fire altar and the umbrella or tree, being superimposed upon two lunar symbols, the cube and the sphere or hemisphere. Subsequently, the saucer and the cone came to be placed on top of the cube and the sphere. So the stupa is not just an arrangement of the symbols of the five elements in ascending order. It is also a synthesis of Indian solar and lunar symbolism, and a synthesis of the principles of yin and yang. It represents, we may say, a synthesis of the different aspects, the opposite poles of our own being, of our own unruly nature. A standard stupa consists of seven essential parts. At the bottom is the square base, the medhi, which, whether it is a simple cube or a number of steps or terraces, usually four, represents the earth element, the yin principle. Next comes the hemispherical portion, which is known in Sanskrit as anda, literally egg, or the garbha, the receptacle, the treasury, the womb, names alive with symbolism. In the case of the Sinhalese stupa, known as the Dagoba, a corruption of the Sanskrit Dhatu Garbha, or repository of relics, this hemispherical portion is actually bell-shaped, a feature which gives the Sinhalese stupas their distinctive beauty. In the Tibetan stupa, the Chorten, the same bell shape is found, but turned upside down. It assumes a chalice-like shape, which is exactly the same as that of the vase of immortality, the Amrita Kalasha, Sanskrit, or Bumpa, Tibetan, which is held by Amitayus, the Buddha of eternal life. This association with the vase of immortality represents the receptivity of the lunar principle to the solar principle, of yin to yang, or even the lunar principle as transformed by the solar principle. Remember too that this portion of the stupa symbolizes the water element, and therefore once again symbolizes the yin principle. The third part of the standard stupa is the cube, which originated from the Vedic fire altar. It is in this section, known as the Harmika, that relics would be enshrined. The Buddha's physical body was consumed by fire, just as his selfhood, we may say, was consumed in the fire of his spiritual practice and realization. So this portion of the stupa symbolizes the fire element, and therefore the yang principle. The fourth portion, the spire, kunta, both umbrella and tree, developed over a long period of time, until it finally consisted of 13 rings of diminishing diameter, placed one on top of another to represent the 13 bhumis, stages of spiritual progress, traversed by the Bodhisattva on the way to enlightenment. In China, this one portion of the stupa, the original fire portion, was separated from the rest to become what we know in the West as the pagoda, a very characteristic feature of the Chinese landscape. It would appear that if the original stupa, the cube and the sphere, symbolized only the yin principle, the pagoda went to the opposite extreme and became a symbol of just the yang principle. We could say, however, that as the pagoda does stand on the earth, which is yin, a balance is maintained. With the earth itself as its base, the pagoda doesn't need a separate architectural base. Although, geometrically considered, this portion of the stupa represents the fire element. In the seven section stupa, fire is already represented by the harmika. So the spire comes to stand for the air element. In either case, whether symbolizing fire or air, it represents the yang principle. The fifth section is the saucer or bowl. This originally represented space or ether, which is a synthesis of yin and yang, but here it becomes a pure white moon crescent and symbolizes the yin principle in a highly purified and sublimated form. Sixthly comes a red solar disk, which represents the yang principle, also in highly purified and sublimated form. Last of all, a flame-colored or rainbow-colored jewel grows out of the red solar disk. This symbol is found not only on the top of stupas, but also surmounting the heads of Buddha images of all countries and all periods, recalling the original meaning of the word stupa, the crown of the head. The Ushnisha, which Western translators rather inelegantly call the Bodhic protuberance, sometimes looks like a flame springing up from the Buddha's head, and sometimes like a lotus bud growing there. The significance of the Ushnisha is the same as the flame-coloured jewel at the top of the stupa. Complete, total synthesis of yin and yang. And what is a synthesis at the highest possible level of the principles of yin and the yang? Enlightenment itself. This is the true meaning of the flame-coloured jewel. It is not surprising, in view of all these considerations, that the stupa is sometimes considered to be the most important of all Buddhist symbols, even more important, both historically and doctrinally, than that other well-known symbol, the Buddha image. It is not surprising that the stupa makes this sudden dramatic appearance right in the middle of the White Lotus Sutra. You may remember that when the stupa appears, the Buddha's disciples entreat him to open it. So Shakyamuni rises up into the air and draws the bolt of the door halfway up the stupa. The bolt draws back, the gates open with a sound like thunder, and inside the stupa is revealed the body of the ancient Buddha, Abundant Treasures, still intact after countless years. Abundant Treasures then invites Shakyamuni to share his seat, so the two Buddhas sit side by side within the stupa. What does this mean? It must mean something. Every single image in the sutra has a meaning. We could say that as Abundant Treasures is the Buddha of the remote past, and Shakyamuni is the Buddha of the present, this incident represents the coming together of the past and the present. Past and present have become one. But the episode has an even more profound significance. We are told that Abundant Treasures is the Buddha of the past. But what past? Not 1,000 years ago, not 1,000,000 years ago, but, we are told, uncounted, uncountable, unfathomable, incalculable myriads of years ago. Now, when you pile it on like that, what you're really getting at is that this Buddha is beyond time altogether. He is not just the Buddha from the remote past, but the primordial Buddha, the Buddha from the metaphysical beginning of things, which means no beginning at all. In other words, Abundant Treasures is the eternal Buddha, above the past, above the present, above the future, out of time altogether. This means that when Shakyamuni, the Buddha of the present, takes his seat within the stupa by the side of the eternal Buddha, Abundant Treasures, the dimension of time and the dimension of eternity coalesce. In containing both Abundant Treasures and Shakyamuni, the stupa contains both time and eternity. So the stupa, as it occurs in the White Lotus Sutra at this point, does not represent just a general synthesis of the yin and yang principles on however high a level. It represents the highest and the most total synthesis of all, the synthesis of time and eternity.